Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. And today I'd like to start with an article from AARP, the magazine, Up Front, What I Know Now. This is by Diana Nyad, the endurance swimmer on shame, glory, love, teamwork, and walking. Hearing the clock, I got a sense early that life would go by alarmingly fast. At 9 years old, I used to imagine being my age now and thinking I had to sleep less so I could do more. Legacy of abuse. As a teen, I just wanted to be a student and an athlete. But sexual abuse by my swim coach, starting when I was 14, threw me into silence and humiliation. I have tried to let go of anger. At 74, I'm living the best life I can. But you don't say to someone who's been through a trauma, "Are you over it?" They're not, and never will be. Finding love. In high school, I didn't know gay people. Didn't see them on TV, didn't have gay friends. I came out at 21 and have been open and proud since. I've also been madly in love 3 times and am still close to each of those women. Marathon swimming. In my 20s, I took up marathon swimming. I swam around Manhattan in 1975. 3 years later, I attempted to swim from Havana to Key West and failed. In 1979, I swam 102 miles from the Bahamas to Florida. Then I gave up swimming for 30 years. Spectator sports. As a broadcaster, I covered the Olympics, tennis, the New York City Marathon, and more. I thought there would be enough art and talent in reporting to keep me engaged, but it started to run thin. Getting back in the water. When I turned 60 in 2009, I wondered, is this how I want to spend my life? I wanted to be a doer again. So I got back in the water and set my sights on the Cuba to Florida swim. I failed 3 more times. Team up. I was a better endurance athlete in my 60s than in my 20s and finally completed the Cuba to Florida swim in 2013 at the age of 64. In just under 53 hours. When I got to Key West, I said to the crowd, "Never, ever give up. You're never too old to chase your dreams. And it looks like a solitary sport, but it's a team." Walk it off. I competed on Dancing with the Stars in 2014 and in 2015 published a memoir, My Friend Bonnie Stoll, and I started Everwalk in 2016 to give people a sense of moving under their own steam and taking in this planet. We want to turn America into a nation of walkers. And finally, nothing special. I meet astounding people every day. No one will ever know them, but they're doing courageous things. I'm nothing special compared to all those people. And this article was as told to Rachel Tour. The movie Nyad, which recounts Diane's epic swim, stars Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. It's in the theaters October 20th and on Netflix November 3rd. Now, also from this issue, Upfront Live, food delivery frustrations. What to do with all the waste that comes with convenience? Piling up in my kitchen is an unsightly stack of reusable grocery bags. Why so many? Because I subscribe to a delivery service. I don't go to the store. But I don't want to pitch the bags and other food packaging, so I talk to experts about what to do. This is their advice. Utensils. The Association of Plastic Recyclers says not to put tough-to-sort plastic forks, knives, and spoons into curbside recycling. Your best bet is to tell the restaurant you don't need them. single-use bags. Don't put thin plastic bags, including those from bread and produce, plus reusable storage bags and shipping pillows, into curbside recycling. They can harm recycling sorting equipment. Instead, find a retailer that has bins specifically for plastic bag recycling. Search for such a location in your zip code at earth911.com. Cold packs. Most frozen cold packs contain gel that could be placed in the regular trash. A small number of cold packs contain non-toxic, drain-safe gel, which you can pour down the drain. Plastic containers. Clean plastic containers and place them with other curbside recycling alongside bottles, cans, and paper. Reusable bags. These thick plastic bags, similar to cloth, cannot be recycled. Your best alternative, donate them to a local food bank. And here we have, not every flame is the same. You don't necessarily need to lug logs into your home for the glow of a fire. Here's a look at the fireplaces available. Wood burning. What people love, the nostalgia factor. I love the crackle and smell of a wood fire and the fact that you have to be present when you build and tend to it, says Nadia Schoenfeld, 55, of Mount Kisco, New York. What to consider? These require regular maintenance, and the fine particulate matter they produce may be a concern for those with respiratory issues. Then there's natural gas. What people love, the simplicity of an on-off switch. Sometimes a client will install a gas unit within an existing fireplace, notes architectural designer Diana Zaglio of McPhee Associates in Dennis, Massachusetts. What to consider? A gas unit needs proper ventilation. Annual inspection of the gas line and installation of a carbon monoxide detector are recommended. Then there's electric. What people love. Ease of use. LED or halogen lights create the look of fire, and the units can blow warm air like a space heater. Electric fireplaces have just enough light and heat to make them fun, says Dominican Brockman, 55, of Ithaca, New York. What to consider? No ventilation is required, so there are no real downsides except for the lack of a natural flicker. And then there's virtual, what people love. Just turn on your TV and stream a fireplace video from YouTube or another service. Some videos add instrumental music or holiday carols over the sound of the fire. What to consider? Besides no ambient heat, of course, there's also the cheesiness factor, and it can take some effort to find the video that you like. Now a look under Money Saver. Store brand savings surprises. Yes, house brand items cost less, but the deals we found were a mixed bag. This is by Karen Hube. How much cheaper are house brand products than their name brand counterparts at your grocery store? To get an idea, in June, we had reporters in three cities price a 32-item shopping list two ways, one with nationally known brands and once with the store's private label alternative, if both were available. Turns out, only 19 products came in both name and store brand versions at all three stores. Here's what we found at an Albertsons in Las Vegas, a Giant outside of Baltimore, and an HEB in Austin, Texas. None of which we have here. 27%, the average savings on store brand products, but savings vary by store. The average savings when a particular store carried both name brand and house brand versions were ranged between 18% and 34%. Savings varied widely by product type. These average price gaps stood out. Campbell's tomato soup, house brands were 14% less than the name brand, a 26 cents difference. Philadelphia cream cheese, house brands were 51% less than the name brand. That was a $3.53 difference. Other standout store brand deals, salt. Morton's salt was $1.43 versus the brand name for the store involved was 54 cents. That's 62% less. White bread, Wonder White Bread, was $3.79. The store brand was $1.39. That was 63% less. And pasta sauce, Prego, was $4.29, whereas the store brand was $2.29, 47% less. But bigger savings on house brands doesn't necessarily mean a lower bill. Although H-E-B's house brands had the smallest average discount versus name brands, the store still had the lowest prices on both categories. Here's how much the carts differed for the 19 products each store had in both versions. The H-E-B store was a high of $78.76, and the store brand was $64.53. The Giant store, the high was $101.91, and the low was $65.71. And Albertsons was a high of $105.31 and a low of $77.18. Now, from an issue of AARP, the Bulletin, under the heading of Your Health, can vaccinations save your brain? There's growing evidence that getting your shots can lower dementia risk. As autumn comes around, so do the placards and public service announcements alerting us to get our flu shots, update our COVID-19 vaccines, and generally get on top of the inoculations we need as we get older. But after 3 years of cultural wars, dogmatic dogfights, and scientific stops and starts, the idea of getting the next shot seems unusually fraught, especially when anti-vaccine celebrities are in the thick of today's political debates. New research has provided yet one more reason why staying on top of your vaccinations makes sense. They might decrease the risk of age-related cognitive decline. Vaccination is the right thing to do to protect yourself from flu and other infections, says Paul E. Schultz, MD, professor of neurology and director of the Neurocognitive Disorders Center at the McGovern Medical School at UT Health Houston. Now, there is also the potential fringe benefit of vaccination, which is reducing the risk of Alzheimer's. In recent years, studies have found that those who get vaccinated for the flu and other infectious diseases appear less likely than their unvaccinated counterparts to get dementia, although it's unclear what happens in the brain to cause this. One theory some experts have is that infection plays a role in developing Alzheimer's disease, and that vaccinations may help stave off these infections. Others, like Schultz, say it's possible that vaccination may reduce an immune system function that attacks amyloid plaque, a protein found in abnormally high levels in the brains of Alzheimer's patients, as an invader causing chronic brain inflammation and the death of nearby cells. The problem in Alzheimer's is that the immune system keeps trying to get rid of the plaque and it can't, Schultz explains. The plaque sits there for 10 years, and the immune system keeps throwing poisons at it all that time and is killing the brain cells in the process. It's also possible that vaccines may enhance the ability of the immune system to remove amyloid plaques. Schultz was the senior author of a recent study that found a statistically significant difference in the incidence of Alzheimer's after following two groups, one vaccinated against the flu, the other unvaccinated. For up to 8 years, he followed them. The groups of 935,887 each were obtained from a national patient database. To ensure valid comparison, both groups shared many of the same characteristics and risk factors, including age, gender, and conditions such as hypertension, Schultz says. Except one group was vaccinated and the other was not. He and his colleagues found that patients who received at least one flu vaccine during the follow-up period of 4 years were 40% less likely to develop Alzheimer's compared with those who did not get the vaccine. Additional analysis found that those who received an annual flu shot had the lowest rate of the disease. The more vaccinations you got, the better, Schultz says. His team has been studying the effects of vaccines for other infectious diseases, including shingles, pneumococcal pneumonia, and the combination of tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, whooping cough, known as Tdap, with similar findings, he says. Another recent study, still to be peer-reviewed, concluded that vaccinations with Zostavax, the early shingles vaccine, among a quite senior population in Wales, averted an estimated 1 in 5 new dementia diagnoses during a 7-year period, according to Pascal Geltzer, MD, assistant professor of medicine at Stanford University, who conducted the research. The exact size of the preventative effect of shingles vaccination for dementia is hard to pinpoint in such an analysis, but our study suggests that the effect is substantial, Geltzeiger said. We believe that our analysis provides compelling evidence that shingles vaccination prevents or delays dementia in this older age group. Virologist Robert T. Schooley, MD, an infectious disease specialist at the University of California, San Diego, who has not been involved in any of the studies, says it is certainly plausible that reducing the frequency and severity of influenza through vaccination can quell immune activation over time. Other conditions associated with chronic or recurrent uncontrolled systemic inflammation, such as chronic HIV infection, can also be associated with accelerated cognitive decline, and this mechanism might well account for the findings, he says. Though experts say the growing evidence is promising, some suggest caution when interpreting the results. No matter how hard you try to control that the two groups are compatible, there is the residual sense that folks who choose to get vaccinated are different in unmeasurable ways from those who do not get vaccinated, said William Schaffner, MD, professor of preventative medicine at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. These unmeasured differences could have an impact on the incidence of dementia and distort the possible influence of the vaccines, he said. Regardless, Schaffner adds, this is not an issue that ought to figure, notably in one's decision whether to receive vaccines. The data are clear that vaccines help prevent influenza, COVID, pneumococcal disease, shingles, and so forth. As I am wont to observe, disease bad, vaccines good. Schooley agrees, saying, one thing is for certain, whether or not this observation is real, staying up to date with vaccinations for influenza and other infectious diseases as we age is a good idea. This for the men in our audience, your health, how I solve my great big prostate problem. Most men will endure an enlarged prostate at some point in life. One man shares his journey to finding relief. I was 61 years old and I was being held hostage by my prostate. I couldn't travel anywhere unless I knew where the nearest restroom was. Must go now emergencies came out of nowhere, and my nights were a series of strolls between bedroom and bathroom. I talked with the urologist, who said that at my age, I was probably dealing with an enlarged prostate. In medical terms, benign prostatic hyperplasia, or BPH. The prostate is the walnut-sized gland in men that produces semen. As we age, it often increases in size, and because it surrounds the urethra, the tube that carries urine out of the body, it can obstruct its flow. BPH can leave a man feeling as though his bladder is always full, even after he's just gone, and make it difficult for him to get the flow of urine started. My urologist offered me a prescription drug to address my symptoms, but I wasn't eager to add another medication to my growing daily regime. so I opted first to experiment with herbal supplements long used in traditional cultures for men's urinary health. Plant extracts such as saw palmetto and milk thistle. I experienced fewer symptoms after a couple of weeks, but the problem slowly worsened until it was clear I needed a different solution. We don't have good data to support supplements, said Naren Nimagata, MD, assistant professor of urology at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. He adds, though, if people are on them and they tell me they have benefit, I don't tell them to stop. There's a lot of that science doesn't understand about BPH, including what causes it, why it's more common in the West than in Asian countries such as China and Japan, and why it may be more common among black men. Genetics, lifestyle, and environmental factors may play a role, says Thomas Chi, MD, a urology professor at the University of California, San Francisco. What is known is that a man's decade of life corresponds almost exactly with the likelihood that he will suffer an enlarged prostate. 50% of 50-year-olds, 60% of 60-year-olds, 70% of 70-year-olds, and so on, will have prostate enlargement, says Mayo Clinic urologist Tobias S. Kohler, MD. But Kohler notes that only about half of those men will experience symptoms because it's not just the size that causes obstruction, but also its architecture, that is, how it's configured around the urethra. I sought out another urologist who ran tests to confirm BPH and determine how much my prostate was interfering with my urinary function. First was a questionnaire. Next was a flow test, in which I peed into a funnel to measure my stream's strength. After that, they put me through an ultrasound scanner to see how much urine was still left in my bladder. Finally came the cystoscopy. My doctor explained that he would insert specialized implements through my penis into my urethra to reach my prostate and bladder. It can be done under light sedation, but no thanks. I chose full sedation as I was frankly freaked out by the thought of anything going in there. This procedure is essential to ruling out cancer. BPH commonly causes blood to show up in the urine or the level of PSA, prostate-specific antigen, in your body to increase. Turns out both are symptoms of cancer as well. And BPH can complicate prostate cancer treatments. A prostate MRI is often used to accurately size the prostate, important information in deciding your best course of action. Once BPH is confirmed, my medical treatment began with the erectile dysfunction drug, Cialis, which is also FDA approved to treat enlarged prostates by relaxing the prostate and bladder muscles, reducing pressure on the urethra. Next up is Flomax, which also relaxes those muscles and loosens the glands. A downside of this and similar drugs is that their side effects can include retrograde ejaculation. It's not typically harmful and doesn't require treatment, but so-called dry orgasm can be unsettling and put the kibosh on the man's fertility. When these medications failed to control my symptoms, it was time to explore other options, meaning surgery. While procedures can be a big jump for some men, the efficacy is much greater than with medications. So this person did have the procedures. 1 year after the procedure, I'm happy to report that my symptoms have greatly improved and the sexual function remains intact. Will I need another procedure one day? Maybe. For now, I'm just happy not to be a hostage to my prostate anymore. Now let's look at a Q&A with Jane Smiley. Reading novels is a form of emotional education. Jane Smiley, 74, the Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist of 1,000 Acres, talks about storytelling, the power of curiosity, and the lessons horses teach. In your new book, the questions that matter most, you describe St. Louis as a perfect spot for a future novelist to grow up. How so? There were many things to look at, so many people to talk to, all different types, sociologically, and all kinds of different cultures. It made me interested in all the people around me. Are for you from a family of storytellers? Yes. And the stories they told us kids were positive. But then I'd get up and go to the kitchen and someone would say, "Now, that's not what happened. Here's what really happened." That was one of the best things for me. It told me that my mother and my cousins thought differently and that they had their own points of view. Your parents separated when you were one and you didn't see your father much, but you write that he gave you two important gifts, your height, 6'2", and his absence. My father had mental issues, which people didn't talk about then the way we do now, but looking back, I think he would have been very domineering. My mother had a busy job as a newspaper editor, and my grandparents were quite easygoing, so I mostly did what I wanted to. I wasn't wild or anything like that, but I had some cousins who were. I didn't mind observing them being wild. You've written several books about horses. What did riding teach you? Because horses are herd animals, they pay attention to what other beings around them are noticing. So one of the key aspects of learning to ride is to not be tense. For me, that was hard because I was basically a little scaredy cat. I'd never been more nervous about riding. It's physical things that make me nervous. You talk in your books about reading as a pathway to freedom. What do you mean? A novel is a way for two people who don't know each other to interact intellectually and emotionally. So if I'm reading Pride and Prejudice, for example, I can relate to Elizabeth Bennet when she gets insulted by Mr. Darcy. That's what the novelist wants you to do. Often when you're reading a novel that appeals to you, you feel a sense of connection to the author in a way that is different from any other form of literature. And as you become more aware of how the characters in the novel are feeling and thinking, you also become more aware of how you're feeling and thinking. So reading novels is a form of emotional education. Didn't you get stuck while writing your novel Good Faith? Yes. Sometimes there's frustration. When 9/11 happened, a lot of writers looked at their work and said, "This is pointless." What I did was read other authors' works all the way back to The Tale of Genji, an 11th century Japanese novel. And the more I read, the more I realized that writing novels was a way of trying to sort out what's going on in your world. That really perked me up, and I got back to my work. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. To be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.